They are elected by you. I am elected by you. I'm constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
They didn't want one person, one man to have all the power like a king.
We show by our work that free people can govern themselves.
You can't pay lip service to the Constitution without obeying it.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society. Welcome to the Necessary and Proper podcast. On June 15th, the Article 1 Initiative was happy to partner with the Federal Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group to host a teleforum discussion with Federal Society members titled, Balancing Executive and Legislative Branch Interests in Congressional Oversight. This call featured an informative conversation between Morton Rosenberg, retired Congressional Research Service senior legal analyst and current fellow at the Constitution Project at the Project on Government Oversight. Also joining us was William Moschella, a shareholder at Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, Schreck, LLP, who was a former congressional staff counsel and later an assistant attorney general for the Office of Legislative Affairs. This call was moderated by Lee O'Connor, who chairs the Federal Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group. We hope you enjoy it. Please send your feedback to articlei@fedsoc.org.
I'm Eileen O'Connor, chairman of the Executive Committee of the Federalist Society's Administrative Law Practice Group. We decided to put this teleforum together because, while congressional investigations are very much in the news these days, the news coverage gives viewers and listeners little or no context, little or no actual knowledge of the history and considerations that must go into balancing the interests of two co-equal branches of our federal government, the interest of the legislative branch in satisfying its oversight obligations, and of the executive branch in enforcing the laws and investigating their possible violation without disruptive interference. The breathlessness, often to the point of near hysteria, of some of the reporting on the current clash between the legislative and executive branches over congressional oversight would make the uninitiated believe that it is without precedent. Far from it. Our two speakers today bring a wealth of knowledge about congressional investigations from the perspective of each of the involved branches. We have not asked them to address the current conflict, but rather to provide the context and history that is missing from news reports. Each will make about 10 minutes of opening remarks, after which they will engage each other and then take questions from as many of you as can ring in. Instructions about how to do that will come as we move to that portion of the program. Speaking first will be Morton Rosenberg. Mr. Rosenberg retired from the Congressional Research Service after a career as a senior legal analyst. He is the author of When Congress Comes Calling, A Study on the Principles, Practices, and Pragmatics of Legislative Inquiry, a link to which is in the email announcing this teleforum, as well as in the Federalist Society website announcement of it. Mr. Rosenberg will explain the history of and authority for congressional demands for information from the executive branch agencies. William Moschella practices law in Washington, D.C., with the law firm Brownstein, Hyatt, Farber, Schreck, LLP. Early in his career, Mr. Moschella served as legislative counsel and parliamentarian for the House Judiciary Committee. I first met Mr. Moschella during the administration of President George W. Bush when he was Assistant Attorney General for the Office of Legislative Affairs. That is the office responsible for DOJ's responses to congressional inquiries. Mr. Moschella will offer insight into executive branch considerations that go into responding to congressional inquiries. Before turning it over to our speakers, in the name of full disclosure, I'll mention that in 2014, I testified at a House subcommittee hearing about whether the Obama administration was actually investigating the IRS's targeting of conservative groups. Mr. Rosenberg, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Lee. I appreciate greatly the opportunity the Federalist Society is giving me to present my views on the natures, scope, and limitations of Congress's investigative oversight authority. My understandings in this area come from my practical involvement as a senior legal analyst at the Law Division of the Congressional Research Service in several hundred congressional committee inquiries over a period of 35 years, from 1973 to 2008, and from continued study and involvement with oversight issues over the past 10 years since my retirement. This period has encompassed two distinct phases. The first phase, which I think of as the golden age of congressional inquiry, commenced just before the unfolding of the Watergate scandal and reflected a renewed sense of institutional purpose, responsibility, and integrity with legislative actions that shored up or even created support mechanisms and revived long-dormant enforcement tools that provided expanded access to executive information that is essential to successfully carry out its legislative functions. That phase effectively ended in 2002 and has been replaced by an institutional acquiescence to aggressive executive claims of privilege that deny that the House and the Senate may exercise their presumed constitutionally based prerogative of information access by means of the historic self-protective processes of inherent and criminal contempt. Instead, they must now seek support from the courts by means of civil enforcement suits, a route that stymies timely, effective oversight. I will try to address two closely related questions. What is the legal and historical basis and scope of the congressional oversight prerogative? And what actions must Congress take to restore its vital co-equal status in our scheme of separated and balanced powers? The law in this area is clear, at least to me. An inquiring committee need only show that the information sought is within the broad subject matter of its authorized jurisdiction, is in aid of a legitimate legislative function, and is pertinent to the area of concern in order to present an enforceable information demand. Numerous Supreme Court precedents over the years have recognized this broad and encompassing power. For present purposes, however, the court's unanimous ruling in McGrane versus Daugherty in 1927, which provided the foundational authority for modern congressional oversight, says it all. That case emanated from the infamous Teapot Dome inquiries of the mid-1920s, which concerned the Justice Department. The select committee established at that time issued a subpoena for the brother of the Attorney General, Harry Daugherty. Daugherty refused to comply and was arrested and brought before the Senate. The action was challenged as beyond the Senate's constitutional authority. The case reached the Supreme Court, which upheld the Senate's authority to investigate charges concerning the propriety of the Department's administration of its statutory mission. The court first emphasized that the power of inquiry with the accompanying power to enforce it is, and I quote, an essential and appropriate auxiliary to the legislative function, and that Congress must have access to the information respecting the conditions which the legislation is intended to affect or change, and where the legislative body does not itself possess the requisite information, which is frequently the case, recourse must be had to others who do possess it. Experience, the court said, has taught that the mere requests for such often are unavailing, and also that information which is volunteered is not always accurate or complete. So some means of compulsion are essential to obtain what is needed. The court also made it clear that the target of the Senate investigation, the Department of Justice, like all other departments and agencies, is a creation of the Congress and is subject to its plenary legislative and oversight authority, in order for it to determine whether and how it is carrying out its mission. Here is the most telling comment relevant to the current DOJ claims of immunity from that process. Quote, the subject to be investigated was the administration of the Department of Justice, whether its functions were being properly discharged or were being neglected or misdirected, and particularly whether the Attorney General and his assistants were performing or neglecting their duties in respect of the institution and prosecution of proceedings to punish crimes and enforce appropriate remedies against wrongdoers. Specific instances of neglect being cited. Plainly, the subject was one which legislation could be had and would be materially aided by the information which the investigations was calculated to elicit. This becomes manifest when it is reflected that the function of the Department of Justice, the powers of the Attorney General, and the duties of his assistants are all subject to congressional legislation, and that the department is maintained and its activities are carried out under such appropriations as in the judgment of Congress are needed from year to year. But despite the High Court's consistent recognition of the breadth of Congress's authority to access information of executive activities, the enduring practical lesson I learned from my 35 years with CRS is that committees wishing to engage in successful oversight must establish their credibility with the White House and the executive departments and agencies that they oversee early, often, consistently, and in a manner invoking respect, if not fear. Thus, although standing and special committees of Congress have been vested with an array of formidable rules and tools to support their powers of inquiry, and have developed over time a very efficacious, nuanced, and staged investigatory process, one that proceeds from one level of persuasion or pressure to the next to achieve mutually acceptable bases of accommodation with the executive, it has been absolutely critical to the success of the investigative process that there be a credible threat of meaningful consequences for refusals to provide necessary information in a timely manner. In the past, that threat has been the possibility of a citation for criminal contempt of Congress or a trial at the bar of the House, a so-called inherent contempt, of an official, either of which could result in imprisonment and or fines. Inherent contempt was utilized in the earliest days of the Republic and was recognized by the Supreme Court as a constitutionally valid and essential institutional self-protective mechanism in 1821. In 1857, Congress added a criminal contempt process as a supplement to the inherent contempt mechanism, making it clear that both of those mechanisms were designed to cover the obstructive activities of executive branch officials. Inherent contempt continued to be successfully used until 1935. Indeed, the landmark McGrane ruling I just spoke of arose from an inherent contempt proceeding. It has since been displaced because it took up too much floor time. In 1975, oversight committees, resting on 150 years of historical practice and judicial recognition of the legislature's inherent constitutional authority to protect itself from non-member assaults on its prerogatives, revived the prevailing threat that a refusal to comply with a congressional subpoena could result in a citation for criminal contempt of Congress with potential jail time or fines. There is little doubt in my mind that such threats were effective until at least 2002. In particular, between 1975 and 1988, there were 10 votes to hold cabinet-level officials in contempt of Congress at the subcommittee, full committee, and House floor levels. All resulted in complete or substantial compliance with the information demands at issue, without the need to proceed to trial. In fact, the threat those instances established was so credible that until 2002, even the mention of a subpoena was often sufficient to move an agency to accommodate a committee's wishes. The last such instance was the failed presidential claim of privilege during the House Oversight Committee Chairman Dan Burton's 2001 to 2002 investigation of the two decades of informant corruption in the FBI's Boston Regional Office. Indeed, that was a bipartisan effort wherein a contempt vote against the Attorney General was a certainty if executive branch officials had not acceded to the congressional demands. Since 2002, however, Congress has come under literal siege by the executive. With particular respect to the congressional investigative oversight, of the actions of executive branch officials, there has been the adoption of an aggressive stance, first officially enunciated by the Office of Legislative Counsel of DOJ in 1984, in direct response to the refusal of a district court to deny the validity of a contempt of Congress citation to the administrator of EPA for failure to comply with a subpoena for documents pertaining to open litigation cases. It opined that the historic congressional processes of criminal and inherent contempt, designed to ensure officials' compliance with its core information prerogative, are unconstitutional and unavailable if the president unilaterally determines that such officials should not comply. In such instances, the Department of Justice will not present contempt citations voted by the House to a grand jury as is required by law. A more recent Department of Justice opinion declared that it had determinative authority whether to prosecute an executive official found in contempt of Congress, even in instances when presidential privilege has not been invoked. The consequence has been that committees have been forced to seek subpoena compliance through civil enforcement actions, a tactic that has been shown in two recent cases to cause intolerable delays that seriously undermines the effectiveness of timely committee oversight and opens the door to aberrant judicial rulings. The most recent such litigation is an investigation initiated over 7.5 years ago and is currently being held in abeyance before the D.C. Circuit Appeals Court. Thus far, the House has not acted to challenge the legal substantiality of the Justice Department's tactic, and its apparent acceptance of the stance that it cannot use its contempt powers has essentially mooted what were once credible threats against executive officials. As a predictable consequence, agencies generally have been reluctant to comply with committee information requests and demands through subpoenas in a timely and complete manner. Indeed, there is little incentive to do so now that agencies understand that refusals require committees to seek court enforcement of their demands, which they are wont to do. There are certainly viable options that can be considered. Congress can create a mechanism on the model of the now expired Independent Counsel Act, which eliminates problems raised by the original act by imposing limits on the length, cost, and scope of the now expired version. But this would require passage of a law, which is not likely to be signed by this or any other president. A second option would be to promulgate under the House's rulemaking authority a more seemly inherent contempt process, one that does not embrace arrest, detention, or incarceration, but establishes a speedy process with due process protections that results in a hefty fine alone. A third option, which would not be preclusive of the revised inherent contempt proceeding, would be a legal challenge contesting the validity of DOJ's assertion that a criminal contempt citation is violative of the president's duty to take care that the laws are faithfully executed and his constitutional status as the executive branch's chief law enforcer. But to the contrary, it may be argued that since the Supreme Court has ruled in an analogous situation that district court judges who found a person in contempt of court is permitted to appoint a non-governmental attorney to prosecute the alleged contemnor as a legitimate institutional self-protective mechanism. Subsequently, the Supreme Court in Morrison versus Olson cited that ruling approvingly in upholding the authority to appoint independent counsels and also ruled that prosecutorial discretion was not a core presidential power. An argument thus can be made that the only ground available to DOJ when presented with a criminal contempt citation, which is a constitutionally based congressional self-protective right analogous to what the court can do, is that it would be a conflict of interest, and that in light of DOJ's rules with respect to such conflicts, a court order might order the appointment of a special counsel pursuant to its conflict of interest rules. With that, I'm anxious to hear what my friend Will has to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Mort. Will, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you very much, Lee and Mort. That was great as usual. I come at this from having worn a couple different hats in my career, and for all those young lawyers on the phone, I hope you have someone like Mort Rosenberg to rely on as you're developing your legal skills. I was a young lawyer on Capitol Hill and in 1994 when Republicans were in the minority for over 40 years, I kind of came of age when there was need for parliamentary and procedural help. I eventually, as Lee introduced me, became the parliamentarian of the Government Reform Committee, parliamentarian of the Judiciary Committee, and Mort Rosenberg was always available to take a call, think through a legal issue, strategize about oversight matters, and I always came to respect Mort because he was a one-man OLC over there at the Congressional Research Service. So for that, Mort, I thank you very much and love to do that publicly.
Thank you.
So I have worn both hats, as Lee said. I was Congressional Oversight Counsel and the Assistant Attorney General for Legislative Affairs and had the opportunity to respond to numerous requests for information. Some of them more painful than others. And the one thing that I would like you to come away with after listening to both of us is that the disputes between the executive branch and the legislative branch are nothing new. I served for a short time at the House Rules Committee, and I can tell you that there was a time where Republican chairmen were so upset about what they viewed as the recalcitrance of various executive branch officials that the House Rules Committee held a hearing just on oversight over the executive branch, and the Justice Department felt compelled at that time. It was basically a hearing in which four or five committee chairmen expressed to the Rules Committee their concerns about the responses from the executive branch, and the Justice Department at the time produced a lengthy letter to then Chairman Linder explaining and summarizing the general approach taken by the Justice Department. So these disputes are not unusual. George Washington was the first president to refuse a House committee's request for papers. It was relating to a foreign affairs matter. President Eisenhower refused to provide information to the Senate based on his concern about releasing material that would infringe on the deliberative process. And likewise, today, we see the current disputes over what looks to be pending case information. So over the next couple of minutes, what I'd like to do is talk about a couple different concepts. One is the notion of accommodation. The second are the department's approach to pending criminal cases. Perhaps in the Q&A, we can talk about closed cases, deliberative process, the department's view about the provision of line agents, et cetera. And then third, I will just touch on intelligence matters and the way those matters are generally handled at the department. Because I do think there's some confusion when people talk about pending cases. There's some distinction between pending criminal and pending intelligence. So the executive branch's approach to requests for information from Congress are one of accommodation where possible. President Reagan in 1982 issued a memorandum for the heads of all executive departments and agencies outlining the general policy toward this accommodation. He noted in his memorandum that executive privilege will be asserted only in the most compelling circumstances and only after careful review demonstrates that assertion of the privilege is necessary. Historically, good faith negotiations between Congress and the executive branch have minimized the need for invoking executive privilege, and this tradition of accommodation should continue as the primary means of resolving conflicts between the branches. The D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals recognized the obligation of both Congress and the executive branch to seek accommodation, and accommodate the legitimate needs of the other. The D.C. Circuit said the framers expected that where conflicts in scope of authority arose between the coordinate branches, a spirit of dynamic compromise would promote resolution of the dispute in the manner most likely to result in efficient and effective functioning of our governmental system. Under this view, the coordinate branches do not exist in an exclusively adversary relationship to one another when a conflict in authority arises. Rather, each branch should take cognizance of an implicit constitutional mandate to seek optimal accommodation through a realistic evaluation of the needs of the conflicting branches in the particular fact situation. Now, Mort mentioned kind of the legal authority of the Congress to obtain information, but I would note that this is not quintessentially, or these disputes are not quintessentially a legal problem. They're a political problem, more akin, in my mind, to a political question. And that is why, while legal tools may ultimately come into play, as Mort outlined, the accommodation process between the branches is ultimately necessary so that the Congress can exercise its legitimate legislative function and the executive branch can exercise its legitimate function. So now I'll turn to the notion that, and which seems to raise the most conflict, the executive branch's view that pending criminal case files should not be disclosed to the Congress. In 1982, the Office of Legal Counsel did a review of assertions of executive privilege in the executive branch. And after that review, and description of the general policy to decline to provide committees of Congress with access or copies of open law enforcement files. OLC concluded that each president, from President Washington and most other presidents, had ratified that position. In fact, they say, quote, no president to our knowledge has departed from this position, affirming the confidentiality and privileged nature of open law enforcement files, close quote. And I am unaware that any president since that 1982 opinion was written has done so. And so the policy is primarily grounded in the need to protect the government's ability to prosecute fully and fairly, and is really built at least on the separation of powers notion that prosecutorial discretion is inherently an executive branch function. Attorney General Robert Jackson articulated the position in 1941. He said, quote, it is the position of this department, restated now with the approval of and at the direction of the president, that all investigative reports are confidential documents of the executive department of the government to aid in the duty laid upon the president by the Constitution to take care that the laws be faithfully executed and that the congressional or public access to them would not be in the public interest. And OLC had explained and summarized some of the prudential reasons why disclosing such information isn't a great idea in the view of the executive branch. If congressional committees are fully apprised of the details of an investigation, they would say that there's a substantial danger that congressional pressure will influence the course of the investigation. The department also objects to the disclosure of law enforcement files because of the potential damage to proper law enforcement that would be caused by the revelation of sensitive techniques, methods, or strategy, concern over the safety of confidential informants and the chilling effect on other sources of information, sensitivity to the rights of innocent individuals who may be identified in law enforcement files but who may not be guilty of any violation of law. I'll come back to that perhaps in Q&A, and well-founded fears that the perception of the integrity, impartiality, and fairness of the law enforcement process as a whole will be damaged if sensitive materials are distributed beyond those persons necessary to the investigation and prosecution. There are other reasons grounded in deliberative process. I'll just note, we can talk about those in Q&A, but generally speaking, the idea would be that deliberations regarding whether or not to prosecute an individual should be kept confidential so as not to chill the ability of prosecutors to do that. In fact, in 2001, Attorney General Ashcroft recommended to President Bush along these lines not to disclose the written memoranda, deliberative memoranda, and other investigative advice and recommendations concerning whether or not to bring particular criminal prosecutions in the campaign finance investigations that went on during the Clinton administration. Listeners might recall that prior to this time, the House Government Reform Committee and the Judiciary Committee were very interested in Attorney General Reno's decision not to appoint an independent counsel, and both Louis Freed, then director of the FBI, and Chuck LaBella, who was the individual specifically brought in to lead the prosecution of those sets of cases, recommended the appointment of an independent counsel. I can't remember if it was the LaBella or Free memos or both were at one point leaked to the press, and They were ultimately disclosed to the Congress to satisfy their need to understand kind of their final recommendation to General Reno. But Attorney General Ashcroft recommended to President Bush not to produce anything further, kind of the deliberations kind of below that level. So the last thing I'll address in my time remaining are intelligence cases. And I'll just, based on my own experience, because I had one while I was Assistant Attorney General. So the FBI is, and actually the DEA, are the two components of the Justice Department, but are also members of the intelligence community. And members of the intelligence community have a statutory obligation to, quote, fully inform the intel committees. And periodically, the Bureau will give what are known as sensitive case briefings to the intel committees, usually just the Gang of Eight, and which are the Gang of Eight are the chair and ranking members of both the House and Senate intel committees, and then certain members of congressional leadership. Well, and generally speaking, at least in my experience, they don't get too granular. They are really to inform committee leadership about trends in intel or counter-espionage, counterintelligence. So, for example, if the government is observing that a foreign power is interested in a particular type of specialized research at A, B, or C university, those sorts of trend lines will be discussed with the intel committees and generally will inform the intel committees at how they're pursuing, you know, that counterintelligence mission. Every once in a while, one of these cases goes criminal. And I had one such case, and I generally did not sit in on these briefings. These are given by the FBI, but every once in a while, my presence was required. And so the long and short of this particular matter was that the intel committees were not happy that information flow stopped, but a decision was made to take this particular case in a criminal direction. Of course, intelligence investigations, counter-espionage investigations, don't necessarily, while they might implicate criminal laws, they're not the criminal prosecution is not the primary purpose. So, for example, if you're just building on the example I just used, it's quite possible that during the course of that kind of a investigation, maybe professor working on certain work is meeting with representatives unbeknownst to that individual, foreign power. It might be the case that the intelligence officials may want to use the that person to provide information to or help gather information about that foreign power.
Will, you and I were talking the other day, and you mentioned something about Congress doing its own fact-finding rather than piggybacking off of that the executive branch has already done.
Sure. So in my view, the Justice Department's investigative arm should not be the short circuit for Congress doing its own investigation. Congress often will run parallel investigations of matters of interest to it, but should not just feel as though they can dip into, you know, DOJ files for whatever purpose. Now, I'll note, there's an example of this, at least one could argue this is an example of this. You know, then-Chairman Henry Waxman asked the Justice Department to provide files relating to the interviews of Dick Cheney and others in the Valerie Plame CIA leak investigation. You may recall there was a special prosecutor appointed for that purpose, Patrick Fitzgerald, and that Henry Waxman had an interest in the interview notes, I believe, and the interview itself. He could have tried to ask the vice president, I guess, directly what was on his mind. I guess he wouldn't have gotten that far. So instead, he decided to go into the Justice Department files. Justice Department, after a consultation with the president, decided not to provide those. This raises another important issue that I'd just like to touch on, and I said that I'd get back to it, but one of the things that I mentioned is kind of the prudential reasons for providing at least open case, and there's still a highly there's a strong interest in confidentiality of closed case files, which is the government has, particularly prosecutors and investigators of the FBI, have enormous authority and power, and they're collecting during the course of investigations a lot of information. And I'm of the view, and I think most share this view, that the Justice Department should investigate, prosecute where appropriate, and if it declines, then to not to say anything. It is problematic, at the least, for the legislative branch to want to kind of unearth investigative documents. Certainly raises lots of concerns where that information didn't come to light because of a public prosecution. There's certainly lots of checks on a public prosecution, and I have no doubt that Mr. Waxman had his own interest in the vice president's interview, but once the special prosecutor makes a decision, for whatever reason, not to use that information in a prosecution, the kind of thing that shouldn't be made public, and you know, you don't have to just use the example of a vice president or, you know, a cabinet official or something like that. I mean, this could happen at a more localized level with an individual that gets caught up in an investigation. There may be derogatory information about that individual, and publicizing those types of files would be damaging.
Right, and contrary to Justice Department policy. Thanks very much to Mort and Will, who provided us all sorts of background information, and there's so much more. I know that each of them could have spoken at much greater length about all the history of this topic. So thank you to Mort and to Will.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article I Initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.